Hi, welcome to Spotter Podcast. My name is Sajal, and join me in parsing through topics on digital disruption. Spotter is a new way to explain old topics. It is a podcast where my attempt is for you to hear a fresh take on an everyday topic that you haven't heard before. Spotter does this by exploring challenges and opportunities of everything digital in enterprises and in society. I try to parse through many topics on digital disruption in an attempt to paint a fresh perspective on topics that you've heard many times over. So thank you for listening to Spotter, and I hope you like this latest episode. Hi guys, my name is Sajal, and I wanted to talk today a little bit about artificial intelligence, and I am trying to make sure that I don't sound like a broken record. So I'm probably going to escape the technical aspects of generative AI as a technology and capability, because I'm pretty sure all of you have understood that pretty well, and you have access to a variety of sources to build that understanding. I think what I'm going to focus more on is what this means for us as human beings, or for us as enterprises and companies, and maybe some of the upcoming challenges that we are likely to face, or not we, but generative AI or AI in general is likely to face. So I'm going to argue for and against it. So, you know, I don't have my own opinion, but it would be good to present all of that to you. So what is generative AI? According to Wikipedia, it's an artificial intelligence capable of generating text, images, or other media using generative transformer models. Generative AI models learn the patterns and structure of their input training data and then generate new data. Now, if you take this statement, you cannot really unpack this statement and make any sense of it. And to make any sense of why this became so popular, and why this was supposed to come amongst us in 2023 and not 2013, you have to go back in time. And the starting point that I define going back in time is somewhere around 2008. Now, 2008 is when there is a very big problem going on in the world, which is the subprime crisis in the United States. What that does is it creates on the balance sheet of almost all financial institutions houses, because people who hold these houses have taken out a mortgage from these institutions and they are not able to pay back. So the more people default, the more houses get piled on to each of these banks. And so there comes a point when there's no money. Now, obviously that has a reverberating effect, and you can read about the subprime crisis, etc. So what happens after that event is that there is a general consensus in society, not a stated consensus, but a general feeling that what we understood of financial institutions before 2008 harbingers of the economy, as money multipliers for people, and as money movers within society, may be true, but the element of trust is not as strong as it used to be post 2008. And that's like a common conclusion that people start drawing, that, you know, is it wise for me to entrust my savings and my net worth with financial institutions? Now, that event over a period of time manifests itself. So right after 2008, governments start bailing out financial institutions because they know that if banks don't exist, then money doesn't move and the economy cannot run, right? Mortgages cannot be given out, savings cannot be made, and you are basically shaking the whole economy. So they start to provide stimulus packages, and these stimulus packages, popularly known as quantitative easing, are given in tranches, two or three tranches. Now globally, US introduces this idea to save their institutions, and likewise in all other markets that have got negatively impacted by the subprime crisis, the other governments and the Reserve Bank of other governments start to do the same thing. So they start pumping money into their respective economies. And then over a period of 5 to 6 years, what happens is that there's a lot of money in the system, in the global economic system, and that dramatically drops the interest rates globally. And if you do a Google about interest rates, historically over the last 15 years, you start to see a sudden drop in interest rates. What does that mean? Well, if I am a business and I'm looking at interest rates going down, I have an opportunity to borrow at a very low interest rates. So what does that do? Globally, you start to then see a mushrooming of small and medium enterprises, startups, and all kinds of companies, because the cost of borrowing goes down and you have a tsunami of VC activity, because even VCs and financial institutions need a return on the money that they are holding. So there's a lot of cash, interest rates are low, everyone wants to make a buck. Startups think they can get money on low equity. The financial institutions want a return, so they start lending and borrowing more. And over a period of time, it gives rise to a lot of VC and startup activity. And all of a sudden, over the next 2 to 3 years, between 2013 and 2016, you have a very big boom in the number of small and medium companies, startups, etc. Now, all of these companies that raise money either through equity or through debt have some product or service that they are providing. And between 2012 and 2016, they need platforms. They need to build technologies so that they can reach, so that the customers that they are trying to reach out start paying for it. And because there are so many startups and small and medium companies, they start to go towards cloud. Now, from Amazon Web Services perspective, they start seeing a flurry of activity where a lot of companies start to come to them for cloud services. And over a period of time, in the same period, over the 2013 to 2016, you start to see a rapid decline in cloud costs because of the exponential mushrooming of small and medium enterprises who are trying to build products and services for their end customers. So the more companies start getting onto the cloud, the lower the cost of the cloud per customer, because cloud as a business starts to hit economies of scale, right? So the cost of building a cloud or a hyperscaler then gets spread over many, many thousands and millions of companies of this size. And what that does is that it creates a cloud market. Azure steps in, AWS is already there, later on Google steps in, and these guys together, along with all other smaller players, take the cost of cost of cloud down even further, because now more people are using it. So it's like a snowball effect. And sometime around 2018 are conditions which are very ripe for large scale AI based capabilities. That's because now you have hit economies of scale as a cloud. So if I wanted to build something on artificial intelligence 10 years prior to 2018, I would need a data center, a server farm, I would need my own infrastructure, so on and so forth, and that would be quite expensive. If I ran large data sets to build any AI model at scale, the kind we see with generative AI, it's going to be very expensive to scale your own infrastructure. And finally, with the scaling of the infrastructure, you would start to also lap up costs because you would be doing it in your own premises, on-prem. That's not true in 2018 because cloud as a business has hit economies of scale. And therefore, it is very easy for me as a company to now really build models that I have been writing research papers about prior to 2018. And that's what happens around 2018-2019. OpenAI starts to build this model that we have in front of us. The transformer models suddenly come to life. Microsoft gets an early peek. So do other companies. They start to invest. And lo and behold, in around 2023, we get a peak of what is now known as generative AI. So it's important to see that in the backdrop of the last 15 years. And then you can see why certain events, largely economic and financial, as well as business related, shaped the journey of us experiencing generative AI. In other words, if this history was different, if the interest rates were very high over the last 10-15 years, we would not see any of this technology around us because it would be just too costly for us to build models like this at scale. Okay, so with that out of the way, the history out of the way, we have now two flavors of generative AI. One is the flavor that you and I experience on a given day, if we want to. And then now there is conversations going about how this technology is going to impact large enterprises, so on and so forth. Now, here's something interesting. When generative AI started, it was able to lap up 100 million users in the most shortest time versus all other prior big technologies that preceded generative AI. But over the last few months, even though the number of downloads have been very high, the usage has been quite low. There's something called as daily active users, which is a very popular metric that a lot of product companies sort of measure to understand how well their product is doing. And the DAUs and the MAUs, monthly active users, have gone down. So people are not using it that much. And it only goes to show that if individual end users are not using it, how could big enterprises use it as well? Because ultimately an enterprise is a collection of users. The second problem with enterprise adoption, and here I am being a little bit speculative because I don't have any data. The second problem is that if humans drive enterprises, then how do you build consensus for this kind of technology in the enterprise? That's the big question. And I argue that some of the reasons that I should not invest in technology at the enterprise are a little bit stronger than some of the reasons I should. First of all, there's a lot of polarization when it comes to generative AI. You know, generative AI as a topic is a modern day version of any other political topic that you may discuss in India or US, where you will always have two or three schools of thought, right? So imagine that in an enterprise, there are three or four decision makers who have to take a call whether to use this technology or not. Now, one guy might come from might build his or her understanding using YouTube videos, conferences, having chats with friends, corridor conversations, family, so on and so forth. The other guy, who might be a little more academically inclined, might read certain papers, might talk to OpenAI about it, go to conferences around AI, and try to understand. And so his understanding would be very different than the first person's understanding. A third guy could simply consume content using Accenture and BCG reports and base his understanding on a more business level. And so you can see that around the table, you have three people who bring to the table a lens of understanding the same topic, which is generative AI, in very different ways. And then if you ask these guys to agree, chances are that for them to agree on a certain decision is going to be a bit challenging. Where's the evidence for this argument? I would like to encourage you all to try to find data around enterprise adoption of generative AI. And as far back as I was able to do that, I did not find anything else but forward-looking statements from companies, forward-looking statements from consulting firms that advise companies, and forward-looking statements from other stakeholders. Right, so that's the first, and you know, you will find a lot of use cases, but you don't see a systematic scaling up of this technology today in the enterprise. It could very well be the case later on. The second reason is pricing. As all of you know, using generative AI, the pricing model is based on certain tokens that are stacked up against certain phrases and words. And you know, you can read about how tokens are used. And so, you know, if you're typing a sentence, that would mean a certain number of tokens. Now, let's say that as an enterprise, you build a business, not a business case, but a use case, which is so general purpose that 70 to 80% of employees are able to use that use case, right? Now, every time all these employees, and employees will run into tens of thousands of people, use the same facility, they are going to increase the number of tokens that will be consumed, right? And I'm not going into the nuances of pricing models. You know, you can read about them yourself. Now, that will create a very unique problem. You know, first of all, you've bought these services from the company, and now you have to pay for running these services. And the more people you attract, the higher the cost can go, right? And I'm largely simplifying this. You can think about people writing the wrong prompts, for example, people not being very sharp with their prompts, so on and so forth, but it would still cost some money because it will be weighed against the tokens that are used for consumption. Let's take the other end. Let's say that in order to prevent this problem, companies can then take an alternative strategy where they find a very specific niche use case that is solving a very specific and niche problem. Well, guess what? If a company does that, it is not going to hit scale. And as a company, do I just want to enable two or three use cases by investing so much in this facility? The answer is no. I would like to scale it. So somewhere there is a catch-22. If you scale it, you may run into certain problems. If you don't scale it, you know, you don't see the kind of ROI that you would like as a company. The third problem is largely political, social, economic, and you know, largely macro factors. First question is of ethics. Okay, so there's a lot of chat about whether this, you know, whether people who have developed this technology have in place guardrails to protect against bias and against what is now called hallucinations. We will never get to know an answer because this was built over a period of time. Has there been enough guardrails and protection against making sure that the data on which the large language models are made represent a certain amount of randomness and not homogeneity? We won't know the answer to that. Will this violate the IP and security protocols and policies of an enterprise which is highly regulated, or will it not? The answer is not very clear. those reasons, accompanied with a lot of political reasons, because all of this can policy usually feeds into a little bit of politicking, and you know, you can make certain ideas about it and throw it into the public and you know, in try to shape people's minds. That is going to be some sort of a decelerator. So obviously, to solve that problem, you need certain guardrails. Now obviously, EU is leading the way. So if you look at European Union, you find that there is an AI Act that has recently been passed in the European Union, and it grades generative AI use cases into 4 or 5 categories. And you know, a quick Google, you can find that PDF. And it will require organizations to make sure that the use cases fall along these 5 to 6 categories that they have defined, so that companies can protect themselves against harm, they can protect their customers against harm, so on and so forth. The final problem is competition. Today in the market, you have 2 or 3 big hyperscaler platforms who are more likely to provide you this service as opposed to a smaller player, right? And needless to say, I mean, it had to be a hyperscaler to be able to bring you generative AI at the cost that it is available today. It could not have been done by smaller companies. So you have to give credit there. But it is often the case that most countries have very strong anti-competition and antitrust policies and guidelines. Either they are at a country level or they are at a regional level, which companies who are endorsing generative AI and bringing them to market will have to address. And so you can imagine that if you as a company try to take a bet on this technology today, you have to assess the maturity of all of these policy and regulatory implications, because what you don't want to do as a company is to invest first and then realize that the policies that have been framed afterwards are harmful to you as a company, right? And so then there's an ROI question and someone's neck will be chopped. So is this the right time to therefore invest? I don't have a clear answer. But what I can tell you is that this is a very good time to start experimenting with this technology. And that is something that all of us should try, either in our professional or personal endeavors. It is a good, and you know, and that's where I'm sort of switching to the light at the end of the tunnel, because I gave you all the pessimistic reasons. There is no doubt that this is at, you know, what you see in front of you in the last 8-9 months is basically the tip of the iceberg. This is going to go in many different directions. This is going to become quite transformational. So preparing ourselves as human beings, individuals, colleagues, employees, to understand the limits and the opportunities that hide underneath generative AI for all of us is very important. And the scope of that opportunity, I personally feel, lies far more beyond than simply doing marketing use cases and content use cases. And I would say that with time, we should keep one eye as a microscope and the other eye as a telescope. We should not get bogged down into details, but at the same time, keep an eye, zoom out, and see where this technology can take us forward. And finally, for all of us, I think it's in our interest to then therefore think, what does this really mean for a company? Is there an opportunity for us which does not meet the eye? It's not on the horizon. And I would invite all of you to participate in that challenge. I thank you for listening to me. And I hope to talk again. And hopefully the next time it will be a bit more interactive. Have a very, very good week ahead of yourselves. And I will see you in a different episode or a different channel. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Spotter. Spotter is a podcast on all things digital and explores the difficulties and challenges and some of the lessons we can draw from looking at stories of digital enterprises. Tell me what you think about it in the comments or in your reviews. Subscribe to the podcast. Do tell me what else I could do for you and what other conversations we could have. The podcast is doing very well. It's already climbed up the charts. It's now in India about 114. The last time I checked. And I want to thank everyone who's listening to this podcast wherever they are. It's also growing in some of the Nordic markets. So thank you to my Nordic listeners. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. And I hope to see you again. Thank you very much for listening.